You have genres, and if you don't read them in their proper historical context and how they were written, it's going to be almost impossible to come to a proper understanding.
Jesus says, I have the keys of death and Hades. This is not a future thing. This is something that he already has.
Why is this significant in the understanding of this particular section?
First of all, I think that bottomless pit is maybe the worst translation in all of Revelation.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where two pastors want to talk about the supernatural and we're not afraid of it. That's right. We believe that Satan is the god of this world. He is causing havoc. He wants to destroy and blind everyone. And we believe the gospel is the power of God to set us free, not only us, but the whole world. And so this podcast is about that very war, where we take the truth of Christ and we tear down strongholds. And we're not afraid to say that there is an actual dark, evil, maniacal kingdom that wants to hurt you and the world. And God has set us here as ambassadors and proclaimers and kingdoms of priests to proclaim the good news of Christ. And your host is Doug Van Dorn, who is the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Boulder, or Northern, sorry. Let's try that again. The Reformed Baptist Church of Northern California.
California.
Okay. You know what? It's been a break.
It's been a couple of weeks off now. But
it is a little California. We'll try that one more time. For those listening, this is a super professional podcast. The pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado in Boulder. There we go. And I'm John Moffat. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And if this is your first time listening, we're two Reformed Baptist pastors who love our church and love preaching. And we believe that everyone around the world needs to know this information because it's healthy and helpful to answer this question. What does it mean to seek first the kingdom of God? And is there an opposing kingdom that Paul tells us in Ephesians 6 that actually is throwing darts at us? And the answer is yes, it is important. And yes, he is. If you saw the title of today's episode, big statement, Doug. It's a big statement. The key to Revelation.
There's also a wordplay going on there as we
were okay.
So it's not quite as maybe it's not quite as big as what we.
No, we're just, you know, these mastermind marketers here. So if you haven't heard last week's episode, I encourage you to do so. If you're new to Kingdoms Unveiled, I'd encourage you to go back to episode one, where Doug and I, or actually technically episode two, where Doug and I start this journey. And we're trying to lay out for you a supernatural worldview through divine counsel and help you understand what we would say covenant theology, reformed theology, and the divine counsel and how they all fit together and why it is all important. And Doug, man, the book Revelation, this is a big one. A lot of people have lots of questions. So we started this kind of a Q&A working through Revelation chapter 20. If you want to go back and listen to that, we're going to pick up that conversation and add some more thoughts to it. And we're going to do a couple of weeks on this. And then eventually we've already committed, I guess, we're going to do a whole series.
And take a deep dive into Revelation. Yeah. Why not, right? Everybody wants to know about this book.
Well, especially now.
Especially now.
All kinds of crazy stuff's going on. All right. So, Doug, a little bit of a wordplay, but it's true. You made a statement. I'll let you clarify it. And then I have a series of questions that I'm going to walk through so that people can kind of hear us interact and really work through some important parts of Revelation 20. Why do you make the statement that Revelation 21 through 3 is the key to unlocking the understanding, or really to understanding the book itself?
Well,
real quick, as an overview, don't give away the whole episode.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question that we'll come back to, right? Because the short answer of it has to do with the repetition of this phrase. He sees the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan. Hmm. That's repeated somewhere else. That's found in chapter 12. And that actually is the very center of the book of Revelation that we're not prepared to tell people about. But that's like what we're going to go through in this series, and we're going to start here in Revelation 20. You could do it in several places, but this one makes as much sense as any place because it's one that so many people have such different opinions on about what is taking place here. And really what we want to do is we want to help people learn how to read this book.
That's right. There you go.
And that's on its own terms, How is mm-hmm. Revelation wanting us to read it? Not yep. how do I want to read it? Not how does the newspaper today's headline tell me that I should read it? But how mm-hmm. is it written? And yeah. and I use the word key here because it's found in our text. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that. I mean, one of the questions at the very, very beginning, but maybe we should just read it again. I think we did this last time, but
yeah,
we're just going to deal with the first three verses, right?
Yeah. We're going to deal with those verses. And you do a really good job of this in your book, which we're going to spend more time here in the future. But the book I'm referring to is, Circles of Revelation.
Rings of Revelation.
Sorry, circles in my mind. We were talking about circles.
We were talking about circle, yeah. So
rings of Revelation.
Stay tuned.
Doug and I are working on something that just might connect all you listeners together. I'll just leave that there. No promises. Stay tuned. in the book, you do a really good job, and I just want to mention it here because, Doug, at times we do weird things with our Bibles. We force our Bibles to be what we want them to be. For instance, we think that the book is has one author from beginning to end, which is true, but it's not necessarily written as a story from one end to the end. Like it's not compiled that way. You have genres and you have different purposes and meanings that are put into these different genres. And if you don't read them in their proper historical context and how they were written, it's going to be almost impossible to come to a proper understanding. So this is a great example that if you try to just pick up Revelation and say, I'm going to read it from beginning to end, and you don't understand the structure and you don't understand the genre, then this is probably what's going to happen to most people. You're going to walk away either one, interpreting it wrong, or two, highly confused, which most people walk away with the second one, highly confused. So that's what Doug and I are trying to get at today, is that we want to help you understand some key moments in the book that you can use to come back and say, okay, this is how the proper way of reading, this is the proper, I would say, structure I need to put my brain into. For instance, reading a repair manual and reading a fiction novel, you don't read them the same, do you?
Hopefully not. I mean, that way, repair manuals are pretty boring, I think, to just sit down and read it first page to last page.
Yeah,
I usually wait for a light in my car. I don't know. Call me crazy. Go to whatever that light is.
Exactly. So, yeah, but the part of a repair manual is that you're going to go to the part you need to repair, and you're going to read it from that point. But a fiction novel, you have to start in the beginning, and you have to read it every word in order. Otherwise, you're probably not going to understand the story. So we are trying to say, hey, Revelation is actually just designed to be read in a certain way. And we want to kind of introduce that to you today from a section. If we show you from this section, then I think it'll help you understand how the whole book works. So that being said, let's start with question one. You good?
Yeah, should we?
Let's read it.
So yeah,
start with reading.
Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while.
All right. So a couple important questions. Who is the angel that's coming down out of heaven? This is important to the story. Who is this guy?
Who is the angel coming down out of heaven? So what we're going to see here we're really just going to ask question after question after question that comes from the text itself. We're going to look mm-hmm. at, you know, this is the first thing that you come upon in this passage, right? There's an angel. Mm-hmm. He comes down out of heaven. So it makes sense to ask the question, well, who is he?
Yeah.
And like, so that's all we're going to do.
Yeah, and, big word, exegesis.
For whatever, for whatever reason, I don't think people just bother to, and we're going to see this especially in a couple of these things, that it's like, well, I never had any idea that that's what that even was. We just mm-hmm. assume things. And I think there's an assumption that's going on here. I don't know, maybe people don't even have an assumption. Maybe they don't know who the angel is or what's going on here. But the short answer to the question, John, is that the angel coming down from heaven is Jesus. Now, that might really freak some people out. What does that mean? Are you talking that he's the angel of the Lord? Well, you know, I wrote a book with Matt Foreman on the angel of the Lord, and I do believe that the angel of the Lord is Jesus. But I don't know that that's exactly what John is saying here. Okay, it's not that he's saying that Jesus, the angel of the Lord, came down out of heaven to do what's about to happen. But so one thing you need to understand is that the word angel doesn't necessarily mean a heavenly being. It just means a messenger.
Yep.
Now, he's coming down out of heaven, and so that gives you the idea that he is a heavenly being. But one of the things that you need to do is read, learn to read Revelation with other parts of Revelation. And then, as we'll get into much later, also with the Gospel of John, because the fact of the matter is that John wrote both of these books, and he wrote them to be read together, which is a little known fact that is so mind-blowing, so incomprehensible, that I still just am like, what? How is this even possible? That's a teaser for way down the line.
That's right. When we get into it, absolutely.
But so listen to a couple of verses from Revelation, early in Revelation, Revelation 10:1. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven. Oh, guess what? That's the same language, John. Wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, and his face was like the sun, and his legs were like pillars of fire. Meredith Klein, in his discussion of this, says that that's very clearly Jesus. This is a Old Testament theophanic theophany language of an appearance of God. This is not some ordinary angel.
Right.
Second one is in Revelation 18:1. And after this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. Well, what angel causes the whole earth to be made bright with his glory? Well, it's the same one that was in chapter 10, whose face is like the sun and his legs like a pillar of fire. If you go back to Ezekiel chapter 1, that's the language of God himself, the Son of Man, sitting on the throne. And so if you read just, if you've read the book already up to this point, it's like, well, he's repeating himself. And so on just that level alone, you can see that the book is already hinting at us that this is something that's repeating itself over and over and over, like baby talk, because maybe we didn't get it the first or second or third time around.
Right.
Now, there's something else, which is that the Gospel of John says things like, no one has ascended into heaven except he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Proverbs 30, verse 4 says, who has ascended into heaven and come down? It's anticipating Jesus' answer 1,000 years early. And Jesus says, there's only one who's descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Now, the question needs to be asked then, that's John chapter 3. So put it into historical context. This is the story, the discussion of Jesus with Nicodemus. Jesus is in his flesh, human flesh, incarnated. He's not an angel. He's a human being talking to a leader of Israel. He doesn't understand his own scripture. And he tells him, the Son of Man has descended from heaven. It's the same language and it's the same author talking about the same person. But now it's the person, very clearly in John's gospel, who is incarnated. So what I think's going on here, using other parts of Revelation and using John as a parallel, is this is hinting to us right here at the start that this is something that has already happened. He is the angel who has come down out of heaven. This is past tense. People read this as future.
Interesting.
I don't think it's meant to be read that way. Now, just one question here is not going to answer that. There's, you know, people that read this book all kinds of different ways, and I understand that, and I appreciate the different ways people read it. And so just this one answer to this one question is not going to solve that disagreement. People will already be having 1,000 questions, like, how can you possibly say that? Well, all we've done is answer one question and try and use the rest of the book, try and use John's other writings, try and use Jesus's own words, try and see that, in fact, it is Jesus. And what makes more sense, that he's somehow transformed into an angel again or something in the future, and then he's going to come down in the future and bind Satan as an angel, or that maybe this is something that is referring to his incarnation?
All right. So your
What's your reaction to that?
No, that's good. Let's talk about it. So I've got a ton of questions. So you're saying that in context, John is, and this is what you're arguing for, and so we'll spend some time getting there. John is writing not a prophecy to be fulfilled. He's writing about something that has already happened.
Using language that Jesus himself used at his incarnation of his own coming in human flesh.
Right. So, okay. So that's the part where it's like, okay, so connect that then. How is this connected to his, are you saying at his incarnation, or is this happening when he descended into the lower region of the earth? Like, how is that connected to this being a part of the incarnation?
Well, I think that we need to keep reading what's going on, and we may not even be able to answer that entirely when we get even to the end of these three verses. Like, this is something that is big picture stuff that you really need to read, for example, Revelation 12. So I said earlier, remember that Satan is given this fourfold title twice, and it's the exact same title. And it appears here in verse 2, and then it appears also in chapter 12.
Right.
What's so interesting is that chapter 12 is very clearly in the section right around where Satan is given that title. This is about the birth of the Messiah, his incarnation, his coming to rule the nations with a rod of iron, chapter 12, verse 5. So that's another thing. Like, if you understand that John is repeating himself, not just with the angel coming down out of heaven, but with all kinds of language that we're going to see as we go through this, then you start to see that maybe I should be reading these as parallel things rather than as temporally consecutive things. In other words, well, that happened way long ago, and now this one happens way later. Okay, there's more than one way to read a book, as you said, when talking about, you know, a car manual. And those aren't the only two genres out there. There's other ways of writing literature that aren't just like writing a fiction book from chapter one to chapter end and everything in between, just kind of, you know, even in fiction, like they'll go back in time and talk about a different story arc that happened. And sometimes you can get lost in that. Like, well, when is this happening? You know, and that's just part of being creative as a writer.
I mean, isn't that how Lord of the Rings starts? Kind of giving you the backstory.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So back here at Revelation 20, we're reading it, kind of a pivotal point, important point, part of it. So we're reading this, and you're talking about John is describing this, and we'll use chapter 12 in the future as we keep going through this. John is describing a past event that he is recording for us, helping us understand part of what's going on in this. So it's fair to say, and let me ask you this, Doug. I'm going to back up, and we're going to like steal a little bit from our series in the future. We're going to give people just enough to come back. But like, how would you describe the book? Or like, when someone says, well, what is the book of Revelation? What's your answer? Like, what is this book? How do you typically answer it in like a real quick, short answer, like a sentence?
Well, I'll kind of blow people away with the answer to this, which is that John's gospel. This deals with the timeline, the 7 year idea, the three and a half and three and a half that you find within the books. Mm-hmm. Jesus' earthly ministry was 3.5 years long, and it was his embodied, incarnated, physical ministry here on earth. Mm-hmm. I believe that Revelation is its counterpart. It's the second 3.5 years. He's the head. The church is the body. Revelation is the body's 3.5 year spiritual time here on earth. And spiritual time and earthly time aren't necessarily the same time, but they're given the same numbers in order to show you that there's parallels going on here. What happens to Jesus happens to his church over and over and over. His earthly ministry parallels in incredibly crazy ways from chapter one to chapter one of both books, chapter two to chapter two, chapter three to chapter three. Same things are happening. in both books. How do you explain that? Well, I explain it through the mystical union, and Revelation is then the church side of what happened to Jesus in his incarnation.
I mean, Jesus warns us about this, right? He says, if they persecuted me, if they hated me, he warns them, this is going to happen to you. So you're saying John's kind of really describing the spiritual, not only the physical, but the spiritual implications of what's happening, like from the unseen realm perspective.
Yeah, very much the unseen realm perspective. That's exactly what it is. It's the spiritual realm. It's not physical realm. I mean, yeah, events happen here physically, but we're looking at it from a different perspective.
So I'm sure you've seen Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
So would you say in many ways, this kind of can be a rough illustration, but it's kind of the upside down world. Like there's what we see, and then there's what's happening in a realm that is active and things are happening, but John's describing what's happening in the upside down.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Another way of putting it is the old phrase, as in heaven, so on earth. There's a mirror going on between heaven and earth, the spiritual realm, the physical realm, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of man. Well, or at least the church, the kingdom of God and his church, what happens, you know, up in heaven, bringing, you know, in the Lord's Prayer, on earth as it is in heaven, we're to pray that there would be this mirror thing happening.
Okay. So with that in mind then, so as you're reading this chapter, so we've kind of introduced a lot of things, you're reading it from understanding that there's John has introduced to us the physical nature and that part of the story in John. And now we're in Revelation 20, we're reading the kind of the spiritual side of it. And you're saying in this spiritual side of it, the connection of this particular, and we're going to, you keep talking about like this, the rings or how it's a circle. We'll get to there. We just kind of want you to
let's just say two things
physical.
Here about the spiritual thing. First of all, people abuse this word horrifically. You're spiritualizing the text as if that means that you're not taking it literally. Well, I'm sorry, but the spiritual realm is a literal thing.
Absolutely.
It is not a pretend make-believe thing. If I spiritualize the millennium, and we're not going to talk about this today, but if I did that, it wouldn't mean that I am not taking it literally. It means that I'm taking it spiritually, and spiritual is a real, actual, literal reality. Right. Heaven is real.
Yeah. So you're arguing to be just like going back and forth. These are my favorite kind of podcast, by the way. You're arguing that this really happened in the spiritual realm.
That's exactly what I'm arguing. One other thing I wanted to bring up, which, and we're not going to talk about this either because this takes us down too much of a rabbit hole, but the first word in the ESV is then. So people will read this. That's a translation decision that the translators had to make. The word is kai, and kai simply means and.
And, yeah.
And so then is a temporal way of reading kai, and it certainly is legitimate. The reason why people do that is because they believe that chapter 20 comes temporally after chapter 19. But that isn't necessarily so. The word kai, meaning and, could just mean, all right, now I'm going to change my storyline. And now I'm going to talk about this, right? So just that needed to be, I think, mentioned just because of where we've taken the discussion so far.
Yeah, I mean, this is normal in any kind of story writing or when you're trying to depict, you've got, so it's almost like you're describing two battle zones. Okay, this is what's going on the ocean front. And now I want to talk to you about what's going on the land. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Like, I'm going to pivot. And it's not then this happened. It's like this happened and this is happening too. Is that fair?
It's possible. Yeah. All I'm saying for now is that's a possible reading. It is my reading. Yeah.
Okay.
The other readings are possible too, but you have to let the text itself dictate it. And that's kind of what we're trying to do as we go through these questions.
Right. Okay. So far we've set up that we are talking about Jesus as this messenger and that this happened in the spiritual realm. We'll get to when. Your argument is that the incarnation, this is in relation to the incarnation. Is that fair? Is that the time frame that you're thinking?
Well, what I'm saying is that just based on all we've seen, which is only the one question so far, we have good reason to be pointed in that direction. Yes.
Okay. All right. So then it says, so we're going to learn more about this character, see if we can learn more about how this relates to the book and what's happening. So the question then, it says he holds in his hand the key, which is the double entendre to the title
of exactly.
the, book, the episode today, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit. So what is this key? Is this, again, we're talking about spiritual things, so we're not going to spiritualize it. In other words, it didn't happen. It's a metaphor, a picture. It
right.
did happen. So what is it?
Yeah. So what is it? Is it actually a physical key that he has in his hands and he's going to go and unlock a physical thing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it maybe a spiritual unlocking, which is still a literal unlocking? Well,
right.
If you go and you go back into Revelation 1:18, you see that Jesus says, notice the tense of the verb, I have the keys of death and Hades.
Hmm.
This is not a future thing. This is something that he already has. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you asked earlier, when might he have gotten that? My opinion is that he got that when he descended into hell. And you can go back and listen to our discussions on that in earlier episodes.
Several episodes, yeah.
It's very important to understand that death and hell, death and Hades, in Revelation 1, are both, in other places, personified as angelic beings. Hades is what? Zeus's brother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And death, Grim Reaper sort of a thing. It's, you know, there's something supernatural, something spiritual going on that's not just talking about the physical dying and somehow a physical place that bodiless souls go to. I don't even know what that really means, right?
Right.
There's a second place where we find this, which is that Revelation 9:1, a star had fallen from heaven to earth, and he's given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. Now, just for fun, stars falling from heaven to earth is not the language of descent, but of fall. That's different, right?
Mm-hmm.
As in Lucifer in the garden, as in he fell.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, there's another key verse, which is Revelation 3:7. It refers to Jesus again. This time it's to the key of the house of David. And these are the only times that you really find the key anywhere, even in the whole New Testament. And you really don't find any supernatural beings having a key at all in the Old Testament. So, like, reading Revelation and the other places it's talked about keys is key, right?
Right?
He has the key to the house of David. Now, this is kind of a echo of Isaiah 22:22. And what it's doing is it's demonstrating through David, who is the king, that the key represents somehow his kingly authority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He has the key. He's the only one that has the keys because he's from the house of David. He is the king. He is the Messiah. Now listen to Matthew 16:19. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And in that passage, by the way, Jesus talks about whatever you bind on earth and loose on earth. And guess what? We have a little bit later in our text here is the language of binding attached directly to keys. So it's interesting to just kind of do an experiment where you just kind of go very slowly through Revelation 20 and just ask questions. Well, what might the key be? What might the angel be? And so there's other things that we can look at as well.
So a couple of things. If you're like, whoa, wait, what? All right, so go back and listen to our episode on the Christ descent into hell. We did two episodes on that, one from the Old Testament, one from the New. That'll explain how he got the key and what it is. And we think that Christ did die, and when he went into the grave, Jesus himself went into the lower regions of the earth. And Peter talks about this, and Jude, and we believe that this is a real event that happened that Paul confirms. He uses it as an illustration of the power. What empowers the church is the same power that went into and set captives free and ascended on high and brought many gifts with them. And it says, he who ascended also descended into the lower regions of the earth. So These are real events. So this is why Doug is saying there is the what we see physically. And then Peter talks about this. And blessed are you who do not see and yet believe. He's talking about seeing the reality. There's a part you can't see with your eyes yet because we don't have the capacity, but it's real. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we hope, right? So we're talking about, so you're saying that there is these other realm, I'm just going to start saying other realm keys that do exist. This isn't like if I were to say it's raining cat and dogs, I don't mean there's actual cat and dogs. That's just a picture. You're not saying this is a picture. You're saying right. there are keys.
It's more than a picture. There's somehow in the spiritual realm, there are keys. And these keys lock and unlock things.
And so according to Revelation, we're talking about pits. We're talking about death and Hades. We would argue death and Hades is an actual location. Well, at least Hades is.
Well, in so that verse, I think that, yeah, I mean, you're dealing with the, what you're dealing with is the loss of your physical body. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with your spirit then descending somewhere, especially in the Old Testament, right? It would descend to Hades. We'll go to that place.
Right.
And Jesus got the keys to that, which means he has the ability to lock people there and to unlock them, to take them out.
Right. So he had, so this is all part of the story. So we're talking about, so John is saying, this is what I saw. I saw someone come down and he had keys. So the argument is that this is Jesus because we're told he has the keys. He's the one who won this. So I'm seeing the connection now.
It's like, right. So now, you can see even just from the second question, how it helps inform the first question. Who is the angel? Mm-hmm. He's the one that has the keys. Who's the angel we said earlier? He's Jesus. But who has the keys throughout everywhere else in Revelation? It's Jesus. So that helps me confirm that, yeah, the angel who came down is Jesus.
That's right. And who also says that he came and got the keys in the outside of Revelation in the New Testament, both in Jesus' own words and in Jude and Peter, it's Jesus who has the keys. Setting captives free. All right. So the key is to a place called the bottomless pit. Why is this significant in the understanding of this particular section?
Okay, so this is like the most mind-blowing one of them all to me. Okay. Oh. First of all, I think that bottomless pit is maybe the worst translation in all of Revelation.
Okay, this is good.
Okay, I think where it comes from is chapter 9. Now, remember we said earlier that there was an angel who comes down to the bottomless pit in Revelation 9:1? But that angel is not, it's going to a different place because there's different word that's used there where it's a place that has a shaft or a well or a cistern. Mm-hmm. And so bottomless pit in that passage is, it's an okay translation. But the problem is that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is abusos in the Greek.
Right.
Yeah. This is the word abyss. Now, here's where it gets so fascinating. 30 times, that's 88% of the time, the Septuagint translates the Hebrew word tehom with abusos. What is tehom? This is the deep, Genesis 1:2. Okay? Mm. The Spirit of God is hovering over the deep. That's the same word as used right here. Nobody would translate that as the bottomless pit. In Genesis 1:2.
Interesting.
Now, what's even more amazing is that there's a creature that lives in the deep throughout the Old Testament. And his name is Leviathan. Sometimes it's Rahab, sometimes it's the Nahash. But those are all synonyms for the sea monster. Mm-hmm. And this is found several times in Isaiah 51, Job 41, Psalm 73, Amos 9, all talk about how there's this creature that lives in the deep. Now, why in the world would that matter, John? Because we're dealing with here in the next verse with someone called Satan and the dragon. Well, what's the dragon? Well, if you go back and you read your Isaiah 27:1, you find out that it's the Leviathan. So if Jesus has the keys to the deep, which is where Leviathan is, that puts a whole nother spin on somehow Jesus is going to lock up Satan, who doesn't even live in this place, in some sort of a bottomless pit. Rather, he's actually going somehow to where Leviathan is, where Satan is, and he's locking him up where he already belongs.
Is. Oh, interesting.
So why in the world do they translate this as the bottomless pit? It just blows my mind.
Well, you can see, like, in the Old Testament, just from using different dictionaries, it's a deep gulf or a chasm is how it's translated or is described. So it makes sense. So I guess, so what do you, I mean, just instead of hiding the, so in your mind, what is Abusus then? What is this place?
It's the place where Leviathan lives. It's the place where Satan is, if you want to put it in that realm, in that language.
Okay.
So in other words, he's not taking Satan from place out here, like say heaven, and then mm-hmm. locking him in a place where he's never been before, that he doesn't belong. Rather, he's going to the place where Satan already is, and he's doing something with him in that place. He's not taking him out of that place, but he's got the keys, and he's going to do something to him in the place where he already belongs. Totally different ideas.
Okay, yeah. So it's from the flow. He has his key, and he says, a key to the bottomless pit and a great chain, and he sees the dragon. So it's not that so we read that in reverse psychologically. We read it as he grabbed Satan, chained him, and threw him in the bottomless pit, but that's not what it says.
That's not what it says at all, right?
Yeah.
He's already there in the place, and he's taking him where he already is, and he's grabbing him, and he's chaining him, and he's binding him. Here's what one dictionary says. Satan is bound in his own sphere, which is also his now prison, which the word prison is used in verse 7 when he's unlocked from his prison.
So the argument would then be somehow in our world, this place exists in another realm.
In another realm, and it might be a lot nearer of a realm than we like to think that it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, because if this is happening now, which we're going to argue for here later, maybe not today, you got Peter warning us that he's prowling.
So he's somehow prowling. Exactly.
Right. Dude, this so goes back to the whole Stranger Things where it's like the two are separate, but they're not.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And
so is this what you're arguing?
This is exactly what I'm arguing. And so you got to think a little bit more about Leviathan being in the deep. He was able to do things to Israel, right? Spiritually speaking. In fact, there's some Jewish literature that uses some of the same overlapping material that's going on here, talking about Satan being bound to keep from doing certain things to Israel during the Exodus. But the main thing that the Psalms talk about is that somehow God overthrew the Leviathan who was there attacking Israel, metaphorically speaking, from the deep. So somehow he's able to reach out and do things. It's not like he's just confined to somehow a water place, right? It's a way of picturing a sea monster known as Chaos, who then is able to go into the world and do all kinds of terrible things to people. Now people go, well, you're not taking it literally. Right. I'm taking it spiritually, but I'm taking it really as true.
Right, because he really does this.
He really does this. He really is, in some sense, a dragon who is somehow associated with this idea of the deep. The deep is a picture of the same thing that Leviathan is, which is chaos, which is a watery abyss, which is the place that you don't want to go. I mean, sailors go down into David Jones's locker, right? And like this is a place that nobody understands. And that's the imagery that's supposed to be coming to your mind.
So is there any connection here with the curse in Genesis 3?
Well, I think the throwing down and the binding is in certain ways related to it. That's kind of a long rabbit trail to get into.
No, but what I mean is like was Satan put into this? Is there somehow a connection?
I think I see what you're saying. So yeah, the Genesis doesn't do much with this. And I think the reason is because it doesn't want Israel's mind to naturally go to the pagan parallel stories, like Marduk and Tiamat being destroyed in the creation story, that kind of stuff. So it downplays the sea monsters, whereas like the Babylonians way up played the sea monsters in creation. All it says is basically, and God created the sea monsters. But then two chapters later, you get a guy named the Nahash, who later is associated as the sea monster. That's so right. I see what you're doing there, I think. And you can see that this same character, the Nahash in Genesis 3, he's not in the deep like he is in Amos. But nevertheless, right. he's still able, he's wreaking his chaotic influence on humanity. In that place, he's doing it in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah. And do you I guess the question is like the binding to the abyss or whatever, Abusus. Do you think that's part of the curse, or did that, you think that, I guess my question is, when Satan was cursed in the garden for what he did, was he already bound there?
No, I don't think so. I think that this binding is referring, this is why the language of the first question is so important. The descent of the angel, it refers very specifically to the incarnation of Jesus.
Oh, not binding. I'm saying he's in this abyss. He's not bound yet.
Right.
In Genesis 3, is he put into the abyss in Genesis? This is a conversation you and I are having live, folks.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
I don't know. It was just a thought
you're kinda,
I had.
You're kind of dealing with mixed metaphors, which is what makes it difficult to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I just was thinking about, as far as like, you know, at some point, this Nahash went from a servant of the king to a rebeller.
Right.
And so he entered into this abyss at some point in his existence.
Yeah, he became at some point the epitome of chaos. And then that becomes pictured for you in that one particular image of him as a Leviathan, a sea monster in the deep.
I mean, dude, we could do a whole episode on this, Doug. My mind is going 1,000 places.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
We're at the end right now. But this makes sense, where it's like you have the physical realm and there is spiritual chaos going on in our physical realm, and the power behind it is a whole nother realm.
So, yeah. So think about, just take that idea again and just the three things that we've talked about here. Jesus has a key. He's coming down to the realm of the deep, which is the chaotic waters. You know, you can actually do a little biblical theology of the water in just Revelation alone, where it starts off where you've got this water that's tumultuous. And then later in the book, it's mixed with fire. And then I think it's actually the opposite way. It starts with a sea of glass where it's completely calm. And then it throws you into this chaotic waters. And then by the end of it, it's like there's no more sea. Because what's happening is that Jesus in this particular place is going into the watery, chaotic mess where the Leviathan creature of chaos is, and he's got a key and he's going to do something to him.
All right. So you may have already mentioned this. I don't know. I don't know where I heard this, but there has to be a play then of Jesus, one, calming the sea, and two, walking on it.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah, the calming of the sea is Jesus.
Hold on. Okay, go ahead. You'll have to wait till next week to get the answer to that question.
There you go.
Because we're both pastors, and we don't have endless amount of time, so we have to break these up into episodes. So thanks for listening. What a fun. I love this. This is a great dialogue. And hopefully you've learned a lot. I know you guys get really upset. You're like, just do it longer. And we really wish we could, but we can't. So we're going to end it here. And we have the rest of, we haven't even got in to verse 2 yet. We haven't even got to the end of verse 1. We haven't talked about the chain yet. So we will pick this conversation back up. We'll answer the question about Jesus in the water. We'll pick ourselves back up on the chain next week. Thank you for listening to Kingdoms Unveiled. If you'd like to learn more about Doug, his books, articles, you can go to douglasvandoren.com and all of his materials there. For me, you can go to theocast.org. And we're thankful that you guys are listening. Please, if this was helpful, like, subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to it, if you're on YouTube or whatever, and share it. And more people need to hear about the supernatural world that they live in, and more importantly, about the good news of their King, the power of God in the gospel. And so if you think this is helpful to do so, please share. Thank you, Doug. And I'll talk to you in about 30 seconds.
Sounds good.